All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've got a packed show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to an interview I did in late December with Hugo Castro, the director of the Border Angels in Tijuana, Mexico. Hugo is deeply involved with and supports the immigrants who came up in two caravans from Honduras seeking asylum in the United States in November and December. While the caravan started in Honduras as they moved towards Tijuana and the border with the U.S., they were joined by people from El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Guatemala. And still a third caravan is on its way to the U.S. border as well. And opening the show up, we'll hear from Sarah Rourke, a contributing editor to RefuseFascism.org. Now we're going to be talking with Sarah about the state of emergency that was declared by Trump and the intensifying attack on immigrants by the Trump regime. She recently wrote, "Everybody knows Trump's wall is based on lies, but how many of us will stand up to fascism?" And that's exactly the question that we've got to get answered here today. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Sure. I got a bunch of questions for you, so we can spread it out, take as long as you want, and but you must answer every question, okay? There you go.
No, let's do this.
Okay. Let's start by you telling people what Refuse Fascism is. As I said, you're a contributor to RefuseFascism.org, but tell people what this group is and what you aim to accomplish with it.
Okay, well, our main website is RefuseFascism.org, all one word, RefuseFascism. And anything that you want to know more about, please surf on over to our site where you can get lots of writings, details. There's pages for donating and lots of analysis. There's fact sheets because it's so hard to keep track of everything that happens in Trump time. Each day is like a new flood of stuff. So it's really easy to lose your way in the current. So there's a lot of resources there. But basically what Refuse Fascism is a group of people coming from very diverse political perspectives. For instance, I'm a pretty mainstream Democrat who volunteered for Hillary in 2016 and would do it again in a heartbeat, even though the loss was heartbreaking. On the other hand, we also have, socialists, communists, anarchists, progressives, so on and so forth, all kinds of folks in the group. I'm hoping to even get some Never Trumpers on board before it's all over, because what we are facing is a fascist collapse of the world's biggest superpower, a nuclear superpower. And that's an all-hands-on-deck moment. That's an all-people-of-conscience moment. The mission of Refuse Fascism is to bring together, to unite all who can be united, to remove the Trump-Pence regime, and I mean both of them, as quickly as possible through nonviolent, mass, direct, sustained action. If you need a parallel, there's the candlelight revolution in South Korea, very recent, in 2016. Nonviolent street protests over several months that eventually wound up involving a third of the country and that successfully removed their corrupt President Park. So there's other models, but that's the most recent one, and it's a very good example of how this can be done successfully. I don't think we're going to get a third of the U.S., but we don't need a third of the U.S. This is an enormous country. We should be able to do what they did. If we're as big and powerful as we like to think we are as a people, we should be able to do this. So at Refuse Fascism, we believe we can do this, and we are making the case that we can do this, and we are demonstrating with our events, our own events. We hold events, and we also attend other protest events.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, and I think it comes off of some of what you were just saying, but you've noted that even as Trump makes his moves regarding the wall, many people, Democratic politicians and progressive people at large, still don't get what's actually happening, because there's an element of like how much people are actually able to, see what's happening and to join in on things and to stand up and to do what's necessary depends a lot on what they understand about what's happening. So what is it that you would tell people is actually actually happening, and where are things going, and what's it going to mean?
Well, I think you just kind of hit the nail on the head with we live in a narrative-driven age. I mean, reality's always been very complex, and humans come up with narratives to make sense of it. And the more complex the world becomes, the more we simplify, in a way, our narratives to understand it. And then it becomes sort of the duel of the narratives. It becomes less about facts and truth and more about who can sell their story the best. So one of the problems we have right now is that there is this narrative out there of we're winning, the good people are winning, the good guys are winning, the Democrats are winning, Trump is losing. He's desperate. He's going to fall apart any second now. It's the desperate lashing out of a trapped animal, and he's done for, which doesn't comport with the facts. If you step back from the narrative that you want to believe and look at what actually happened just now, you will see that it's not winning for the good guys. We've just moved our needle so far. We've moved our bar so low that losing less now looks like winning. But if we can try to keep our consciousness of who we were before 2016, and look at this through our normal eyes that we had before all of this, disorienting chaos came, we very rapidly see that this is insane by those standards. It's insane to say that this was a victory for the good guys. I think that the Congress did, the Dems in Congress did fight, not enough, but they did fight to try and mitigate harm, but that's not the same as winning. And time is not on our side. There's an erosive problem of the democracy's ground is crumbling out from under us as we fight. So, just backfilling is not going to be, it's not going to ultimately be enough. And that's all that's going on. And selling a narrative otherwise is, I think, putting us into a dangerous complacency. I understand why they're doing it, and it's not completely evil why they're doing it, but it is absolutely the wrong course. And we've been here in history before. Weimar Germany went through a lot of these same processes, and we are repeating a lot of the mistakes.
Mm-hmm. I want to step back for a minute, because you've described this as a seductive narrative that's going on, the idea that no matter what, that the system will adjust and correct what needs to be corrected. And I think it's important. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to look at that, because you also argue that people have to open their eyes and see what's actually happening. And to me, that's one of the things about, watching the State of the Union, basically what was being put on there, and the chanting of, USA, USA, frankly, by both Dems and Republicans.
Oh yeah.
And this kind of, there was a really, I mean, you want to talk about a Nuremberg rally? That really reminded one of that,
Yeah. Well, if you're asking me about the State of the Union, people paint it as just more of his usual incoherent rambling. I happen to disagree. He does ramble a lot, but this speech I actually regard as being pretty brilliantly evil in the way it sort of deliberately swung between carrot and stick and sort of set groups of Americans against each other and tried to get the buy-in of people who normally would not be responsive to, a fascist sales pitch. But then he turns around and says, oh, hey, we're going to cure AIDS. Anybody who's been paying any attention, especially since Trump himself disbanded the AIDS Commission, and who sees what Trump is doing in terms of to trans people and trans people in the military, especially, and also in terms of supporting religious conscience laws that discriminate against gay people. He's not the queer community's friend. He is an enemy of us. So if anybody actually believes that promise, but he made it, he still made it. And just like Van Jones, when Trump said, hey, Van, come to the White House, we'll work on criminal justice reform. Well, Van Jones wants that so bad, and I don't blame him. We need it desperately. And that he allowed himself to believe that Trump is going to be the source of that justice reform. If you step back from what you want to be true and look at how Trump has behaved, you will absolutely know he's not your justice reform guy. But it's so easy, and I thought he actually did a really good job of trying to pull in new groups and also forcing applause lines even on the Democrats. The Democrats did not have to chant USA. That's entirely on them. I will take them to task for that. But there are other places where, here's a child, here's a veteran, here's a Holocaust survivor. You have to clap for those things or look like a jerk. And then you have to say clap when things like peace, is mentioned. So I thought it was a very successful exercise in getting the Democrats to look like they were buying into a lot of this, and probably, sadly, to actually buy into way too much of it.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sarah Rourke, a contributor to RefuseFascism.org, an organization mobilizing to drive out the Trump-Pence regime through a sustained nonviolent protest movement. Yeah, I think that's really true. And I think, you know, look, there's a whole point here, too, where a lot of what was going on there was this manufacturing a crisis. And this is what Trump is doing. He manufacturing a crisis and then proposing to solve it with the expansion of his executive power, which is a very, I mean, this is, you think about what that means in the world today. This is a very dangerous thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the reasons I was so alarmed when I woke up this morning is that the shoe dropped. I've been expecting it to drop. For some reason, a lot of people did not think that of the possibility that he could sign the legislation and declare an emergency. I think people had it in their heads that if he quote-unquote caved, he would quote-unquote cave completely. Obviously, this is not a cave. He's keeping the government open, and he's going to get his emergency. But I'm alarmed at the relative lack of response to it. This was a major escalation today, and yet I'm seeing really not that much furor over it. And what you were saying just now about this emergency declaration, you know, if you understand the powers that he gets in an emergency, if you understand how little oversight the Congress really has, if you have all these facts at your disposal, then you understand that once he's been written this blank check, it's probably not going to get rescinded, and that he can and will use it far beyond the scope of what is intended. That's partly a flaw in how the Emergency Powers Act was written. But that's where we stand. And it is blowing my mind today that people do not recognize this for the profound loss that it is. Mm-hmm. People are, like I said, really hooked on this narrative of the Democrats winning. And they're also hooked on this narrative of creating an emergency. He's manufacturing a made-up crisis. He absolutely is. Absolutely. He is Reichstagging this thing. But there is a crisis that is not manufactured, and that crisis is his emergency declaration, is his holding the government hostage and starving it. He, you know, possibly by repeated shutdowns. There's no reason he can't do that. Drips and drabs. Look at what he did this last time. Longest shutdown on record. Look at what that did to us. And the knowledge that he can do it again is going to be present in negotiations from now on, as long as he's president. We know he done it. He can do it again. And that people overlook how much leverage he really has and is willing to use just to reassure themselves that everything's going to be okay is, I think, fatal. I mean, people cling to this idea because they want to believe that they're holding on to their safety and security. But I think in telling ourselves these comforting lies, we're actually dooming ourselves to unsafety, insecurity, unfreedom. You know, we're losing what we're trying so desperately to hold on to by desperately trying to hold on to it. We have to recognize that the ground has moved. There's been a tectonic shift. That's not where we are anymore.
Well, let me ask you this, because I think this is tied into that, because you've also argued that what Trump is doing now is, in fact, an existential threat facing humanity as a whole. And if let stand, it could have really dire circumstances, really dire effects.
Absolutely. Like I said, you know, people ask me how, when I predict something that Trump was going to do correctly, they say, how do you know? You know, and I tell them it's not prophecy. It's not smarts. Just read history and believe it. Because all this is, you know, or something very like it has happened before somewhere in history. And what he is doing now is what many dictators before him have done to seize absolute power, whether suddenly and brutally like Hitler did, or, you know, over time, as other dictators like, I would say, Orban in Hungary is doing. But Carl Schmitt, the Nazi philosopher, legal analyst, Timothy Snyder, the historian, has quoted him, and I think it's very apropos. Carl Schmitt says that one of the ways you get absolute power is the permanent emergency. Sovereign is he who declares the exception. Because if you can suspend normal rules and you control when normal rules come back, then effectively there are no more rules. So all you have to do is convince people that this is such an emergency that you need those powers, which is, of course, exactly what the Constitution was meant to guard against. But the Constitution is only paper if we don't enforce it. If Congress doesn't enforce it, and they're not, and the people don't enforce it, and so far we're not, then it's just words.
Let me ask you this, and we're coming up on a close. I think I have maybe one more question, but they might blend into one another. But there's this whole point about, look, a lot of people know that Trump's wall and the whole idea of this is based on lies. I mean, it's really interesting because people, even, you know, I think that even people that are in his camp recognize that there's a certain amount of lying going on, but they accept it. And they accept it as sort of the, if you say it enough, it'll be true. Now, this thing is, you know, his wall is factually is based on lies. But you pose it as that's the case. It's factually based on lies. But how many of us will stand up to fascism? And that's actually the question that you're posing to people now.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, if truth and reality were going to win this, you know, this struggle for America's soul and humanity, then we would have won it already. So many, you know, debunkings are out there of his thousands and thousands of lies. Nobody who actually wants the straight dope on that it can claim ignorance. The facts are out there. They're very clear. So people who claim that they're not convinced of the facts are lying to you or lying to themselves or probably both. So if you dispense with that, obviously this is not about the facts, then what is it about? Well, it's about power. It's about narratives. It's about the fascist myth of past societal glory that is to now be reborn into a new era, make America great again, through purging the culture of alien and corrupting elements. That's the basic myth of fascism. And it is a myth. There's nothing about it that's realistic. It doesn't work, but it is seductive enough to destroy whole societies, and that is what we're in the process of. So yeah, I when people keep quoting fact after fact, like more facts are going to finally convince these people who have made clear they don't give a crap. That's another thing that blows my mind. You have to concede that that's not the ground this is being fought on. You have to move over to where the ground is, which is about power and decisiveness, moral courage and action. If we are inert and the bad guys are active, guess who wins?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right. I want to thank you very much. Actually, you know what? I have one more question. See what we can do on this. We're running out of time, but I have just one more question. It's related to that. And it's because you've actually stated this is only one question ultimately matters here. And I thought that was a really important thing to state. And I wanted you to expand on it a little bit because it's actually what we're saying to people, I think, in terms of, you know, look, if you sit here and you watch this fascist regime consolidate itself, you watch what Trump is doing, you are opening the doors for horrors that are undreamt of, for things that are going to be much worse than the worst horrors that have ever been come down on the planet. And you're looking at the possibility of all that happening, and you have a chance to step in and stop it. You know, and that's the thing. So only one question ultimately matters here. What are you telling people with that statement?
I am telling people that that they need to get out of their political thinking. And I'm not saying kumbaya, hug with the Republicans. That's complete bull. That's not what's going on here. This is about people who believe in humanity versus people who believe in fascism, hate, and cruelty. Those are the tribes now. People who know me as a loyal Democrat, you know, which I still am, are constantly expressing their shock that I'm working with communists, socialists, anarchists, you know, Bernie supporters, all kinds of people on the left who I deeply disagree with, but that I am, because that's not what this is about. These are good people. They're brave people. They're willing to stand up to fascists. They're willing to take my hand. I'm willing to take theirs. And we are going to stand up for humanity in its dark hour. And then we can go back to fighting about all the other stuff. But if we don't make it, if we can't dismantle fascism, then nothing else any of us wants for humanity, whether you think capitalism is it or communism. Nobody gets what they want under a fascist regime except fascists. So that is absolutely, you know, the thing.
All right, Sarah Rourke, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. We've been talking to Sarah Rourke, who is a contributor to RefuseFascism.org, an organization mobilizing to drive out the Trump-Pence regime through a sustained, nonviolent protest movement. Their slogan is, "In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America," something that everybody needs to be looking into right now.
We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Outer National, joined by Tom Morello with Somos Todos Ilegales. In late December, I traveled to Tijuana, Mexico, to report on the struggle of thousands of immigrants who made their way to the U.S. border from Honduras and other countries in Central America. For the people who came to the U.S. border seeking asylum, it was a matter of life or death. What they got upon arrival at the U.S. border was tear gas and razor-sharp concertina wire. Nonetheless, they refused to leave and found shelter in Tijuana while they waited to try to cross the border again. When I told friends that I was going to travel to Tijuana to report on what was happening to the immigrants there, many, many people suggested that I talk with Hugo Castro, the director of the group Border Angels in Tijuana. I found Hugo at the Border Angels office maybe 50 yards from the border fence. The once neutral territory called Friendship Park, where people had been able to meet and talk with their relatives without the iron fist of the Border Patrol, was now open for only 2 hours a day, and scores of people desperately lined up along the border fence, hoping that they might somehow get a chance to talk with their loved ones on the U.S. side of the border, even though the border remained closed. And their desperate attempts to meet with their relatives were shut down by the U.S. Border Patrol and the U.S. Army. Hugo and I sat down to talk.
Tell people your name and what you do.
Hugo Castro. I'm a Border Angels director here at Tijuana.
For a lot of people that don't understand what Border Angels is, what does that mean?
Border Angels is a nonprofit organization mainly focusing in providing support for migrants.
When you say support for migrants, is that like across the border? What does it mean?
The organization is well known because we are the ones who provide water. We go and drop water at different zones, especially at the desert, the mountain region, where migrants cross to the United States. We try to decrease the suffering and the deaths at the border. We also provide free immigration counseling for migrants. For instance, right now, we have every first Sunday of the month, we have in Playas Tijuana, right here at Friendship Park, we have a free immigration counseling for migrants. Most of the migrants that come here are the ones that have been deported and they're looking for a way, a possibility to go back to the United States. Mm-hmm. So they don't have to pay here. They receive a free counseling from accredited immigration lawyers who are volunteering with Border Angels.
Now, just one more thing on your personal story. You had talked about this a little earlier when we weren't able to get the thing running, but what actually drove you to do that? What was it that made you take that leap from your life that you were living to what you're doing now?
I served a 2-year sentence for a marijuana-related case from 2001 to 2003. I ended in a federal private prison, Taft, California, where I got aware that most of the fellow inmates that were there were serving time for unjust laws, unjust sentences for illegal reentry. They were there, a lot of them were serving 1-year sentence, some of them 3-year sentence, and I met a guy that was serving a 5-year sentence because they just wanted to go back with their loved ones in the States after being deported. So that motivated me to try to make a change. I had an opportunity to continue studying while I was in jail to distant learning courses. I graduated from college, and after that from university, I got freed, I enrolled in San Diego State University, where I met two Chicano professors who were Chicano activists in the 70s. So they guided me to know what to do, and I started to work mainly on Imperial Valley regions, also San Diego, but mainly in Mexicali and Tijuana.
Mm-hmm. You're looking at the situation that exists now, and there's been a buildup of these kinds of things. Like when you were talking about going out and dealing with water for people for immigrants that are crossing, and there's been a real sharpening of the attacks on immigrants in every quarter, it seems. I know that I have a friend who has, she's part of a group in Arizona that goes out, and she also was part of the study that was read where they actually found that the authorities were going and smashing the cans of water or poisoning them or throwing the bodies of dead animals in water. There was all this very, very thought out and cruel, very cruel, sadistic thing of going on of anything to stop immigrants, including in a desert, preventing them from having water that was left out for them. Is that the stuff that you saw too?
Yes, we have been talking to Border Patrol agents about this incident because there's a YouTube about it. They are Border Patrol agents. And what they reply is that that water was not going to be drink by migrants, that they were criminals, drug smugglers, that wants to go through that path. Isn't that true? That's their rhetoric.
Mm-hmm. Now we come to today and what's been happening in relation to the immigrants now. You know, people trying to cross the border, like the Hondurans coming up, there's been a whole big international and national, particularly with the U.S., there's been a national onslaught against these people, saying that people shouldn't be allowed in with them, they're criminals, they're this, they're drug dealers, they're whatever. And mainly what you see is you see people coming up, and it's a whole different story. So, and you've been involved with this from the first explosion of it. So let's talk about, tell people what is going on and who are these people?
I have seen, in the case of Hondurans, I have seen the trend, it increased in the last years here, but I noticed a trend of Hondurans coming here to this region instead of going to the Texas region in 2012 because of they were sharing information that this path that is known as a devil route because of the high temperatures, especially in the regions of Sinaloa, Sonora, and also here Baja California. So they come in the train to Mexicali, and from Mexicali they come here to Tijuana. So they discovered there are a lot of shelters in Mexicali helping the migrants, and also here in Tijuana. Just here in Tijuana, there are 25 shelters to help the migrants. So that's the reason they started to come here, and I was asking what pushed them to leave their country. What I saw and still see here, there's a lot of families. You know, I see women with children, I see couples, and they say they're running away from death. Violence has increased instantly in the last years, not only in Honduras, but also in El Salvador and also in Guatemala. And there's no way to continue living. They don't feel safe. Some of them have been their relatives, or they have been through really bad actions as rape. They have been raped. One of the family members have been killed. Some of them were tired of paying extortion. If they have a small business, even though it is informal business in Honduras, they have to pay extortion from $100 to $400 monthly just to continue working, you know, as a protection, supposedly. So they're tired of all that. So that's the reason they decided to run away from there, from violence. All this time, I have been involved with since 2003. Helping the migrants that go to shelters here in Mexicali, Tijuana. In the case of the Central Americans, most of them are people who just want to find a job here. They are family members, they are not criminals. There's no image of criminals in my mind. I sometimes sleep in the shelter, you know, and I'm safe. Nothing has happened to me. I haven't been assaulted or I don't know of an incident or crime incidents regarding Central Americans here in Mexicali or Tijuana. So it's not true. First, with the migrants, with the undocumented migrants, Trump wanted to blame someone to find the perfect scapegoat to blame for all the difficulties the country is going through, and also to find a way to stop migration from people of color, you know, from brown people. He's not against migration from Europeans to the United States, he's against migration about Central American and Mexicans because he's racist. So I don't think they are invading. They are just running away, and they want to cross the border. I have seen here for the last months, Central Americans arriving to playas, and they stay at the shelters that we help here. And sometimes I have seen when the migrants jump the fence, they jump the wall. But in the last months, the Border Patrol agents, instead processing them, capturing them and processing them and taking to the detention center or to the Border Patrol station, they threat the migrants, push them, cause fear on them as a way to make them jump the fence, jump the wall back to Mexico. So they are not following the protocol that they should follow. Especially when these migrants, as soon as they cross the border and as soon as they face a Border Patrol agent, they ask for asylum. They say that their life is in danger in their country. And, but anyways, they are being sent back to Mexico.
You know, when you look at what happened last week, for instance, with Trump actually basically encouraging and allowing and actually calling for these military people to shoot tear gas at children. What did you think of when you saw that? Because here they are talking about how all the immigrants coming are, they're criminals, they're gangsters, they're going to hurt people, they're going to do this. And here are some people, lots of little kids, that actually got fired on with tear gas.
I wasn't there. I was attending an event here at Playas because we have an event last Sunday here at Playas, and I couldn't go to try to support the migrants that were trying to march in a peaceful way before that. But there were some friends who are activists, in case of Sergio Tamay, who was he's from the organization Angels Without Borders from Mexicali. And he was there, and also a friend who is a reporter from NHK Japanese TV. He filmed when Sergio Tamay was telling the Border Patrol agents and the soldiers that the migrants were just trying to be there to cross the border, but in a peaceful way, that they were not violent. They were children with mothers, with a lot of women with children. That response from the agents was that they started to shoot the tear gas cans and also the rubber bullets. Actually, the NHK reporter, his name is Hideharu, he got injured in his leg, as well as many of the migrants got injured by the cans. And also, they feel really bad throwing up, and they were scared. They just ran. And I think that this action was not correct. You know, they were invading the country. They were responding with weapons to another country. You know, this is something really shameful. Man. How can you respond to refugees instead of opening your doors and opening your arms to receive them and to welcome them? How can you dare to harm them, especially when there are a lot of children? I don't understand this action. This is really a shameful action from the U.S. government.
And it's also, I mean, you look at the increasing fascism that's been arising since Trump came into office. And this is, I mean, the kind of things you think about this, you know, he's made these comments that, well, we would never do something like that. We would never do something like that. And then they turn around and they are. They're shooting tear gas at children.
Yes.
You know, and you compare what the Nazis did and how they actually treated people, treated the Jews, treated other people that weren't Germans. You know, it rings very familiar when you look at what's happening here now.
Yes, he's dehumanizing the migrants, especially the ones who are darker skinned, especially with Central Americans and Mexicans. Hitlerian tactics, such as constantly repeating lies to transform it into truth. That's the way he's working right now. Now we don't have a concentration camp, but we have a lot of private detention centers and private prisons that actually do not provide enough the basis for the refugees or the migrants or the undocumented migrants who are serving time right there. Now we are facing a really bad racist environment that is blurring the mind of many Americans. Many Americans who doesn't have a clue how are the conditions here in Mexico or at the border, and and they are afraid of migrants, you know. They see that the migrants gonna bring diseases, and they're gonna increase the crime rate, and it's not true. They're just want the migrants who are just want to continue being alive and survive in another country. These migrants still see the U.S. as the land of the free, you know, the land of the dream, and in a safer place to stay at instead of their country.
Now, one question I was thinking about too is that you also had some people who were very defiant last week and have been defiant in terms of what the U.S. is doing to people, what the Trump regime is doing to people, what they're saying to people. And I found it really important that there was this element of immigrants that were, you know, saying, no, we're not going to turn around. We're not going to lay down. We're actually going to fight to have a life, to be able to have a life. And I wanted to know what you thought about that.
Talking to a lot of migrants, and what they say that they're not going to go back to Honduras, because they go back to Honduras, they're going to die there. So they say it's better to die trying to reach your dream, fight for your dream, than to die in your land. So that's the reason there are still more than 6,000 of them right here in Tijuana. There's more than 1,000 in Mexicali, and 1,000 of them are in their way to the border. So I think that they are not going to be stopped by a wall. They're going to try to find a way to cross the wall.
Now, what would you say to people in terms of, if you wanted to deliver a message to people that are going to hear this, they'll hear it all over the country in the U.S., what would you say to people that they need to know?
They need to know that this is the consequence of the U.S. interventions in these countries. You know, in the case of the infamous war against drugs that has just caused the increase of violence in deaths in Mexico and Central America, we should implement another strategy trying to decrease the drugs consumption in the country. This is not the way that it has to be handled, because it has been transformed to a war against the poor in Mexico and Central America. And also the interventions in Central America to have like a right-wing governments that has increased the level of poverty, extreme poverty, in the countries that people are running away from direct violence, and also they are hungry. They want to find a way to survive in another country. So that kind of interventions that come from either Washington or New York, it makes people trying to go to the United States. So many Americans think they don't understand what's the reason they are going to the States. They see just as invaders. They are not invaders. They are victims of forced migration. That's the reality. They are victims of forced migration, and until we find a way to help them, you know, if we stop intervening in that countries, that creating more chaotic situations in that countries, that only is affecting the citizens and forcing them to migrate, this trend is gonna continue.
Mm-hmm. And what do you see, like, in terms of right now, what needs to be done right now? Because this is a critical point. I mean, you're pointing out all the people that are coming, all the people that are here in other cities and states, as well as, you know, the people that are right here now. Let's talk about what Border Angels sees as necessary to do right now. What do you look at in terms of the critically important response that Border Angels is telling people that they need to respond in this way?
Yeah, we need to work to create a humane immigration reform. First one in the States, to be able to protect the ones undocumented that are right now living in the States and have a right to be in the States, to live a normal life in the United States. But also we need to respect the international treaties. You know, our countries, they follow the international treaty with the United Nations to process asylum seekers as fast as possible. For instance, right now here in Tijuana, even though there are more than 6,000 migrants in Central America that arrived with a caravan, and 2,500 before them, the mainly Mexican, displaced Mexican from very violent states such as Michoacán, Guerrero, and Veracruz, that were asking for asylum at the border. Still, the U.S. just processed 200 of them weekly. You have more than 8,000 waiting at the border. How can you just process 200? I think that instead of bringing thousands of soldiers to the border, there should be hundreds of clerks or officials to process them, you know. instead of having soldiers here, we will have asylum processors at the border, and it will decrease the crisis here at the border.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we are talking with Hugo Castro, director of the Tijuana branch of Border Angels, about the outrageous assault by the U.S. Border Patrol and soldiers on Central American immigrants trying to seek asylum in the United States.
What would you say to people that you think it's really important for people to understand about who the migrants are and why they need to do something around this, why people need to stand with them? What would you say to them?
We have to accept that there are more than 250 million human beings living in other countries. They're migrants, you know, 250 million because of the neoliberal strategies in governments around the world that forced them to migrate. And we have to understand that most of them are human beings. They are family-oriented people. They are family members who just want to survive. So we have to humanize the migrants. We have to stop the demonizing the migrants and criminalizing the migrants. It's only in the United States and a few other nations around the world that criminalize the migrants. Most of the nations welcome the migrants. Right now, we have heard us in the case of one veteran who was living here, Orozco, his last name. He was living here in Tijuana for the last years, and he couldn't cope here with the situation in Tijuana, and he tried to cross the border again last year, and he received 7 years for illegal reentry. Imagine, this is a U.S. deported veteran receiving 7 years, and now he's serving time in jail because of these unjust sentences. We have to separate what is government and what is corporation. Now the United States is run by as a corporation. They are seeking the best interest of the stockholders and the 1%, the rich people who has probably stocks in the private prison industry and other industries that benefit from people being sent to jail. Instead of bringing goodwill to the majority, we are harming the society with this kind of actions the government is working right now.
You're confronted with, in certain ways, a big crisis right now. You're up against something that's really huge, and I want to talk about that a little bit because I think that's a big question right now. The people in the shelters, what I heard about, I haven't seen that original shelter that was around, but the original shelter that they had put so many immigrants in, and it just seemed like a walking hell.
Yes, yeah. The government, the local government, didn't act as supposed to at the level required by the beginning. They were kind of in a denial stage. They were saying that just around 300 of my migrants were going to arrive to Tijuana, and the rest of them were going to Tamaulipas. And we were in the reunions that we have with government officials and also shelters and migrant rights organizations. We were telling them, hey, no, they're gonna come here in Tijuana because Tijuana has more shelters, and they want to try to be here at the shelters in Tijuana. And they were in denial. First of all, that place couldn't be called a shelter. It was a small building without roof, without walls, without infrastructure, without bathrooms. And that place was a mess, you know. They were living in really bad living conditions, all wet. They couldn't use the bathroom because the bathroom were without service. They wouldn't receive a service as required for the more than 6,000 living there. They weren't receiving enough medical attention. The medical units arrived like 5 days after the peak arrived to the border. So actually, the Tijuana city mayor, he has done a lot of declarations. He was having declarations that human rights were for right humans, telling that the Central Americans were not enough human beings. He was stating that he was using 500,000 pesos daily to support food and services for the migrants. Most of the basic, you know, they weren't pumping the 10 portable toilets that they have right there. And they were just receiving one meal a day without medical attention, without enough clothing, and without tents. Most of the tents that were there at the Benito Juarez Center were donated by the organization. We donated more than 100 tents and hundreds of sleeping bags and blankets, food and diapers, and we have delivered tons and tons of donations. Only an organization, Border Angels, plus other organizations that were helping the caravan, you know. There's a lot of assistance coming from other sources, from nonprofit organizations. So the government is not doing enough right now. It's not acting as at the required level of emergency. This is a humanitarian crisis. We have been declaring that Tijuana is under a humanitarian crisis since years ago. Since 2013, I was here in Tijuana. I came to Tijuana to live in 2013 because I was arrested and when I had a vigil right there at the border, protesting against the killings of migrants by the Border Patrol agents. And I was arrested and I was detained for 10 hours. And I realized that most of the people who were there detained were undocumented. No, not undocumented. They were Mexicans deported, undocumented. They didn't have an ID and they were arrested because they didn't have an ID. And it is an illegal action because in Mexico, the police officers don't have the right to ask for an ID. You cannot be arrested, supposedly, for not having an ID. But here in Tijuana, they were doing that. And I was claiming that it was a humanitarian crisis because of thousands of Mexicans were deported through the border, and they were coming here in Tijuana, staying in Tijuana because it's easier to be here in Tijuana and be in contact with Southern California. Just 2 hours from LA, there's a lot of buses that come here, take you a round trip to be able to visit your loved one here, deported in Tijuana. And it costs you $29 to go the round trip. So a lot of people do that. And they were staying here, but also there were a lot of displaced Mexicans running away from violence coming to Tijuana. And also a lot of Central Americans coming to Tijuana. In 2016, with the exodus of Haitians coming from Brazil and Venezuela, the bomb exploded and the crisis got harder here at the border. Now with the massive exodus of us, more Central Americans, it's a really tough situation because of, there's no way they continue their path. There's no way to cross the wall, you know. There's a lot of Border Patrol agents and now soldiers custodying the wall. And also there's more security implements such as the wire fence that is almost impossible to climb the wall here from Friendship Park. This is a very symbolic place that it was opened and inaugurated in 1971 by former First Lady Miss Nixon, where families could talk each other from both sides of the border and have a family reunification, at least symbolic here at the wall. Now it is closed. The Border Patrol say that because of security reasons, I don't see any possible tough situation here at the border, and they closed it when the Central Americans arrived to Playas 3 weeks ago. So now there's no way families can see their relatives, their loved ones, through the wall.
Now, one question I wanted to ask is, and it's because it's something that the press has brought up and the mayor that you were talking about brought up, is this whole idea that somehow the vast majority of people in Tijuana are anti-immigrant, that they just want people pushed out of the way. And yet when you see these demonstrations of people, it's like 115 people or whatever, you know, it's not like a mass upsurge of people going in. But what is the situation in relation to the immigrants and the people of the city?
The reality is that many of the Tijuana residents were scared. They were scared of the possibility of the U.S. shutting down the border. So a lot of Tijuana residents work in the United States, especially here in Playas. I think there are more than 60% of the residents of Playas work in the United States. They commute each day to San Diego. They cross the border daily from Mondays to Fridays, most of them. So they were scared about that action. I don't think that the majority of Tijuana residents don't like the caravan members, the migrants. I was here when almost 3 weeks ago the incident happened when some of Tijuana residents threw stones at Central Americans trying to push them to leave the area. At that time, there were around 100 or 80 of them. 2 weeks ago, they were at a protest around 300. But 300 doesn't represent not even 1% of the 1.8 million Tijuana residents, you know? You know, 300 is nothing. Some of the residents, their minds have been blurred by some social media, especially not formal media, that are just trying to show the bad aspects, the negative aspects of the caravan. And, you know, they are following obscure intentions. And some of them are kind of scared or reluctant to accept that they are actually running away from from there. But the majority of Tijuana residents, you know, welcome the caravan. I have been hours in the previous temporary shelter in Benito Juarez, and I have seen cars that in really bad conditions, you know, with expired tags, with not really good, strong engines, you know, I don't know how they drive it. And they arrive there loaded with used clothes and food and sandwiches and coffee and oatmeal. And I have asking them, hey, where you come from? Oh, you know, this is something that we are doing by ourselves. We don't have an organization. We just family members. We migrate from Michoacán several years ago, so we know what it means to leave your home. We migrate from Veracruz. I saw a lot of people arriving to the shelter and showing they were poor people. You know, they were not rich, but they were poor people showing a gratitude to the migrants because they also suffered that in similar situations in the past. And I saw a lot of it, especially Christian churches that arrived with church members. They were giving food and also clothes and diapers and many, many other products needed at the shelter. Tents and also sleeping bags and blankets. So I have seen a lot of people helping. Tijuana is a migrant city, you know, it's a tourist city. And most people see it as a city that welcomes everyone. But as I told you before, there was just a small number, 300. 300 of them doesn't mean nothing.
One last question, and it's something I asked before, but I wanted to get a little bit more into it, which is leaving aside going to the governments and demanding they do whatever, let's talk about in terms of the planet and the people. And what would you say to people all over the world that they need to be doing in relation to the situation now facing these immigrants in Tijuana and the immigrants that are continuing to come up? Because the way this world has been shaped and all the stuff that's been done through things like through the U.S. imperialism, through the British, through all kinds of this, what has been shaped in the world and what it's done to people is people have left everything they know to come to try and be able to stay alive and help the family stay alive and hit this. So I want to know what you would actually say to people. Because I know Border Angels, and I know you, from when I interviewed you a few times back in the past as well, there's more than just sort of we need to rely on the governments. You actually challenge people to do something very, very particular in terms of morality too.
Yes, we need to organize ourselves. We cannot be just waiting for a time the government is gonna change. This trend is gonna continue if we don't organize ourselves to create a change. You know, this is the same puppets that go to power. You can see right now Trump, you know, a billionaire, you know, who make his fortune is squeezing, you know, taking out the blood and the sweat of workers. How can you expect someone that kind of a morality level work for the benefit of the majority? You know, it's impossible to think that. We cannot be naive. We have to push our people who have the ideology that really want to help the majority, who are not starving in a hungry for money and not for values. We need people with values and power. We need that, you know, we need to push for alternative forms of government, not the basic, right now is the Democrat Party and the Republican Party, the kind of the only ones that really have the possibilities of being in a government, when both parties are the same, you know. We have to really change for a socialist ideology party, or at least officials and candidates that can push to create a better world.
All right, Hugo, thank you very much, man. Anything else you'd like to say?
Yes, don't believe the fake news. we have to understand that all these mass of people that is arriving to the border, they are not pushed by hidden interests. They are pushing by hungry and also by fear. They fear of dying in their country, and that's the reason they are here. And we should respect them and see them as human beings, not because you have or you don't have a piece of paper, a document that shows that you are kind of legal in a country. that doesn't make you a less human being. We did, you know, our dignity should not be based on a piece of paper.
Tell people what Border Angels is about, what you guys do.
We are an organization, a binational organization, that works to decrease the suffering of the migrants. We work to push for a humane immigration reform. We have a direct actions trying to prevent the deaths at the border, providing water, providing blankets to the migrants across the border. We provide free immigration counseling on both sides of the border. We provide also labor rights counseling to day workers working, looking for a job outside the Home Depots in San Diego. We provide also labor rights in counseling here in Tijuana, and also we are working in projects to provide jobs for not only deportees but also Central Americans. So we fight for to reduce the migrants' way to the cross, you know.
All right, thank you very much, Hugo.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have been listening to an interview I did with Hugo Castro, the director of the Tijuana branch of the Border Angels, and we've been talking about the horrendous assault on immigrants from Honduras and other parts of Central America who have tried to claim asylum in the U.S. But instead of getting that, they were gassed, beaten, and forced to live in unsanitary and overcrowded camps scattered across Tijuana, with little hope of ever making their way into the U.S. That brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank both of my guests today, Hugo Castro and Sarah Rourke from Refuse Fascism, and each and every one of you for tuning in. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and my engineer, Teddy Robinson. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with another piece from Outer National. Here is The Rose. Talk with you again next week.
When nighttime his loneliness sinks in, you're getting in a mischief. I'm listening. I want to hear your thoughts, see it all. Like a heat waves through the walls. You want to go out tonight, you want to know what it's like when the wind's in your lungs and the fire is in those eyes. Coffee.